I'm Glenn Moberg in for Ben Marins on At Issue. We are broadcasting live from our new studio at UW Stevens Point. And for the next hour, we have a very special live in-studio guest, Jean-Michel Cousteau, underwater explorer carrying on the work of his legendary father, Jacques Cousteau. He's also the leader of the Ocean Futures Society, a nonprofit organization dedicated to marine conservation, research, exploration, and communicating the issues facing the world's oceans. He is also the host and producer of a PBS high-definition series, Jean-Michel Cousteau, Ocean Adventures. Well, he's been here at UW Stevens Point for much of the week, sharing his efforts to battle the environmental threats facing the world's oceans. And tonight he has a public appearance at 1800. That's in the Century Insurance Building in Stevens Point, right off the Business 51 entrance ramp. If you're interested in coming into town to see him, it's at 7 o'clock this evening. It's a Wisconsin public radio show. And he is here to talk to you. This is a very special opportunity for you to share your thoughts with someone who is on the cutting edge of ocean research and the fight to save our threatened underwater ecosystems. We're taking your phone calls at 1-800-486-8655. Tell us about the appearance tonight at the theater at Century's at 1800. What will the audience see?
Well, what I've done all week is to make sure that the people who are honoring me with their presence understand the connections that they have with the ocean. The fact that the rain that is falling right now is the ocean, that the water they're drinking is the ocean, that the skiing they're going to do this winter is the ocean. And so we all connected to the ocean one way or the other. Unfortunately, because we are land creatures and we kind of resist when it comes to water and getting there or in there, we use it as a sewage, a trash can. Mm-hmm. And we're affecting our life support system, and we're affecting what's living it, what is living in it. We're destroying the habitats, which are very critical for most forms of marine life to find a place to hide from predators or reproduce or to find food or for a bird to stop on their migration or whatever. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you live along the coastline or if you live far upstream, and I would say upstream because all those little streams and rivers, Mississippi, Missouri, and so on, they are the roots of the ocean. And everything we put into it, if you live in Topeka, Kansas, is going to affect the ocean.
We used to have the feeling, human beings, for so long that the oceans were so vast and so deep that there was no way we could affect them.
Well, we
that
are.
Was wrong.
Well, that was wrong because in those days there were fewer people. We're now more than 6.5 billion people. We add in another 100 million people to the planet every year, so the demand and the pressure on a finite resource, which is the planet, is increasing, and that we've reached certain levels where nature is saying, I can't handle it anymore. So in the past 20, 30, 40 years ago, it was okay. But now we've reached those limits in many, many ways. And we have to face up to it. And with the young people particularly who are going to take over, I think they're getting the information and the education which will allow them to make better decisions, to come up with new inventions. And there are people at work doing that when it comes to harnessing energy, growing the kind of food that we need in a sustainable way, stopping losing a lot of the chemicals that are affecting the environment when they originally were there for a good purpose and then they have subsequent consequences.
You mentioned young people. You've been sharing your message with young people here at UW Stevens Point all this week. How's that been going?
Well, from my point of view, it's been going very well because, first of all, they showed up. And secondly, they have very good questions. And when they ask questions, I'm learning something. I'm learning where they stand. I'm learning about their priorities. I'm learning where they want to go. And sometimes they can challenge me, and I don't have the answer, and I tell them so. So it forced me to go and find the answer. So I really like to speak to young people. And it doesn't matter if it's just college students, but and I also love the younger ones because they're like sponges. They really absorb the information, and I've done that for 30 or 40 years now, mm-hmm. and that will resurface when they have to make decisions as adults.
This school, UW-Stevens Point, really puts an emphasis on environmental education. Do you find the students are tuned into that ethos?
Absolutely, absolutely. They really, many of them are really focused on those issues because of the kind of questions that they ask, I can tell that it's getting there.
In a lot of ways, you're carrying on the work of your father, Jacques Cousteau. How are you trying to build on his legacy?
Well, you know, I grew up with him, and I've been infused with his philosophy. And
is it true that he threw you overboard at the age of seven with newly invented scuba gear on your back?
Yes, well, which he co-invented, and he wanted to test it. And together with my mother and my brother and myself, we went diving again and again and again. And that's it was very important for me, from an educational point of view, because that's how I was a witness, seeing that we were using the ocean as a trash can. And as a child, I mean, 8, 9, 10 years old, I saw my own backyards, my own playground being literally demolished and abused and overfished, and people were using chemicals to catch fish, dynamites to catch fish, and now it's almost a graveyard. So it has made me really want to change the way we as a species look at the ocean.
It must have been wonderful growing up with him.
Oh, he was a wonderful gentleman, and when he unfortunately left us 12 and a half years ago, I decided to create Ocean Future Society to honor his philosophy so people can have a living Cousteau. We can, with his team, a wonderful team, many of them work with my dad, and I have children who have been involved and are more and more involved, and my nephew and niece are also involved in their own way. And so there's a third generation of people
of
who can communicate. Yeah.
Tell us about Ocean Futures. What are you trying to do? How are you trying to do it?
Well, Ocean Futures was created to continue doing what we've always done. We're producing... The mission of Ocean Futures is very simple. You can read the long version, which I don't remember, but the short version is, if you protect the ocean, you protect yourself. Now, what do? We communicate. It's all communication. One is television. Television is massive, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. Two, but it's not as much in depth. Two, we have educational programs. Ambassador of the Environment, which takes kids out of school with their teachers, and we bring them near the water. Could be a river, a lake, or the ocean. It makes no difference. And we establish these connections, and in the process, we pass on the information for those young people to understand how to work as a team, how to build self-confidence, and that's part of the program. Then we have another program which is called Sustainable Reef and also Sustainable Rainforest, which is being put at the disposal of schools. Sponsorship does that. People really believe that it can make a difference, and they help. And then finally, I call it diplomacy, where I go and sit down with decision makers both in industries and governments, and we talk about some of the issues, and I provide them with as much information as possible so they can make better decisions.
I find it interesting that you're so concerned about the rainforests and terrestrial environments, as well as what's going on under the ocean.
Everything is connected. I mean, we can't get away with it. And when you clear-cut a forest like they do, unfortunately, in the Amazon at the moment, and before the end of our discussions, the equivalent of 1 to 2 football fields will have been cut off. That topsoil at the next rain is being washed down the streams. It goes into the largest river system on the planet on a piece of land which is as big as continental United States, encompasses part of 9 countries. And it ends up in the Atlantic Ocean with everything we put into it. And the topsoil is being washed away, and nothing can grow again. So we really are hurting ourselves by poor planning, poor management, if you want. And that can change, and it's all education.
And I guess as an American, we have some trouble responding to this. When we try to get people to conserve the rainforest in the Amazon, and they turn around and say, you're from Wisconsin. You clear-cut that beautiful boreal forest that covered your entire state 110 years ago. It's our turn for economic development. How do you respond to that kind of an argument?
Well, the fact that you use economic development is probably a sales tool which, in fact, will backfire. And unfortunately, when we do clear cut instead of selecting trees, that topsoil is washed down the streams. It goes into the Mississippi, and now you have a dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi, which is increasing. When I was there in 83, it was a third the size of what it is now. Nothing lives there except bacteria. And it's as big today, as big as the state of Pennsylvania. Are we winning? Is that something we really think is a good thing? Absolutely not. So it starts at home. It starts in our fields. It starts with our industries. Everyone can contribute to changing it and making sure we don't continue using the ocean as a garbage can, because it's backfiring on us.
If you just joined us, I'm Glenn Mobergen for Ben Marins, talking to Jean-Michel Cousteau, who is with us at UW-Stevens Point. We're broadcasting live. He's been talking to the students all week. He's got an appearance tonight at Century Insurance's At 1800 Theater. I believe there are still seats available. And we do want to encourage you to call in with your questions and comments. This is an unusual opportunity for you to talk to a guy who is really on the cutting edge of not only ocean exploration, but saving some of these fragile ecosystems, which we have devastated over the past several decades. 1-800-486-8655. Let's go to William in Sun Prairie. William, you're on At Issue. Hello, William.
Yes, hello. How difficult is it to go way deep down in the Black Sea? I understand there's very little oxygen down there. The timber ships that have sunk down there are very well preserved. I understood that the Turkey did not want your father or some people to go deep down into the Black Sea. But how difficult is it to explore the bottom of the Black Sea?
Well, essentially,
and how old are those ships that have sunk down there? What's their age? Are they 5,000 years old? 10,000 years old?
Jean-Michel, how difficult is it to explore the bottom of the Black Sea?
They're definitely thousands of years old. But today, unlike in the past, the existing technology or the equipment or the submersibles that are available can go at any depth. What's important is to find out how the visibility is. How can you see? Because the problem in our case is that, you know, we're visual creatures. That's our primary sense. And if we cannot see anything, well, there is a problem there. But because the water is pretty still, chances are that it's more than likely very, very clear, or clear enough for us to explore. It can be done. It's a matter of organizing an expedition and finding the funding to support it and then going there and filming and reporting.
The caller seemed to indicate that there are very old shipwrecks at the bottom of the
yes.
Black Sea.
Yeah, our civilization started there, started in that general vicinity, and whether it's the Turks or the Iraqis or whatever, that's where it started. And so there's been vessels on those seas and lakes since the beginning of the presence of humans, in terms of being very creative and wanting to explore away from the coastlines.
Any effort being made right now to recover some of those old wrecks?
Not that I know of, and very frankly, we have other priorities which have to do with the preservation of life, not the dead things. Although I understand archaeologists are very interested, but that's Ocean Futures is not in that field. And inasmuch as my father and I and our team were exploring and since, you know, in the early 40s, we switched on to other priorities.
The organization is called Ocean Futures, not Oceans Past.
That's right.
1-800-486-8655. If you would like to talk to Jean-Michel Cousteau, I'm Glenn Moberg in for Ben Marins. We are broadcasting live from UW Stevens Point. We'll be back with more right after this short break. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Ben Marins. The show is At Issue. We are live at UW Stevens Point with a very special guest, Jean-Michel Cousteau, who's been telling us about the Ocean Future Society, and we've talked about everything, it seems, except how you join and become a member.
Well, you can join at www.oceanfutures.org, O-R-G. It is free online. And we've done that because we didn't want children to have to ask money from their parents. It doesn't mean you cannot make a donation, but that's a different issue. And by being a member, you can ask us questions on an ongoing basis, and we have people in our office who will answer your questions always. Our website is what it is today, but major changes are going to take place between now and the middle of December. And the names of the members, because they are children, minors, are protected. They are not exchanged, given, or sold. It is totally protected. So the byproduct of that, which is interesting, and I didn't know when we made that decision, is that now we can team up with other NGOs because we're not competing for money or membership money with them. And that allows us to join forces, different organizations with different talents, but in going the same direction, and we're much stronger.
Oceanfutures.org.
Yeah.
And anybody can join, and it's free.
That's right.
We have a number of people who want to ask you questions. Let's go to Mary in Muskego. Mary, you are on At Issue with Jean-Michel Cousteau.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. Now, I happen to be over 80 years old.
Yay! Wonderful!
I think so, too. Now, I've been listening to National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio for many, many, many years. Now, it might be that I might have even heard your dad speak sometime on the radio, and I certainly know about him, that all the marvelous work that he's done through his adult work and all his interests. Now his son is carrying on. Now what I would like to hear, please, are the positive things, the things that you are doing, carrying on his work, that is helping the ocean. What can we people who are, you know, on this planet can go to bed tonight and say, well, I heard Jacques Cousteau's son speak, and it isn't all bad news. There's hope there, and the hope that he told us about is thus and so. And so I would like, you know, this thing about hearing the bad part of everything about our water and about the ocean, about the air, about the everything is quite frightening. And so I wish you would just stir up a little positive thinking and something that would make us feel better about hearing you.
Thanks so much for the call, Mary.
Yeah.
Do you have any reassurance for her?
Oh, of course. And you know, it's just great to get these kind of questions from people who have seen a lot. And I cherish those questions always. What most positive thing that I can say is that we have now an audience and young people in particular who are the future decision makers, and they are gobbling up that information. They are really being educated, and they really will be better decision makers. So in as much as this wonderful lady and myself may not be able to see the results, we are heading in the right direction. And there are positive things that are already taking place. I was in the South Pacific not very long ago, and there's an intercontinental hotel that generates the entire air conditioning from the difference of cold water temperature at about 300 feet of depth, which they bring up, circulate in the air conditioning system, and put back in the ocean untouched. And they're not using any energy, traditional energy like fuel. And they're saving between $1 and $1.2 million a year. I mean, here's an amazing answer to some of the problems we have to face up to. And there are many other issues. Now, as a person at home, if you have a bag to go shopping, keep the same bag and like your bag and cherish your bag, because every one of us, we in the United States, we consume between 1,000 and 1,500 plastic bags every day. And every year, I'm sorry, every year. What a waste. Now, in my community in Santa Barbara in California, and perhaps here, I don't know, when I go shopping, I bring my bag, my own bag. I've had it for several years.
You can do that in supermarkets here.
Well, you know what they do? Where I go, they give me 5 cents back, and they save 5 cents. And if I do it 100 times a year, that's a lot of money. I can invite you to lunch or dinner with the same income. So there are many things we can do when it comes to leaks or the use of electricity when we don't need it, and on and on and on. And at the end of the month, you make more money.
You were saying that the young people, and the young people you've been talking to here at UW Stevens Point is an example of that.
That's right.
Their hearts and their minds are in the right place.
That's right. And if you can reach the heart, and that's everybody and every decision makers, even those who haven't had the privilege of having that kind of education that is available today, you sit down with them and you reach their heart, and suddenly the defense mechanism goes away, and we can have a conversation, and it goes up to the brain, and they're making better decisions. And I'm very, very excited today. As an example, I did it with President Bush, where we ultimately saved, you know, the largest piece of ocean.
I want you to hold that thought, because we've got to take a news break.
Sure.
But that was one of the questions that's up next on a number of questions that I want to ask you. And we're going to get to as many of your questions as we can, too. Our lines are full right now, but you can wait for somebody to be taken and then call us at 1-800-486-8655. Jean-Michel Cousteau, I'm Glenn Mobrick, in for Ben Marins, live at UW Stevens Point. More after this news. I'm Glenn Mobrick, in for Ben Marins. It's At Issue. We are live at UW Stevens Point with a very special guest, Jean-Michel Cousteau. I want to remind you that you can see him later this evening at 7 o'clock at Century Insurance's 1800 Theater. That's off of the U.S. Business 51 entrance, just as you come into Stevens Point. He'll be speaking at 7 o'clock. And we're going to get to as many of your phone calls as we can in the next half hour. But before we broke for news, Jean-Michel, you were talking about the fact that you helped convince President George W. Bush, who many did not consider to be an environmentalist, to name an area off the northwestern Hawaiian Islands as a huge marine national monument. How significant was that?
Well, it was significant in many ways. One, it proves that everybody has a heart, and everybody, provided you provide the right information, can make very important decisions. And that's what happened. I was not there to when he invited us at the White House and show our television programs, which went on PBS, called Voyage to Curry. I was not there to point fingers or accuse him of anything. I was there saying, we need your help, Mr. President. Are you aware of what's going on out there? And when he saw the film and when he realized what was going on, he took action because he has the power to do it. And that's what we need to do, is everybody who has, you know, the power of making decisions, whether it's at home, in your community, in your city, or in your state, or in the government, or in the world, and we can make a difference. We need to work together.
You're doing the series Ocean Adventures. You've made, 75 films, and you've won a Peabody and an Emmy. And taking those underwater shots must really be a challenge.
It is a challenge sometimes. It's getting a little easier because of the equipment that we have, the weight of the equipment, the fact that we're shooting now high definition instead of film. So we are up against the wall when it comes to budgets. It's always unbelievably expensive. But the budgets that we have today, with no compromise on the quality, are the same budgets that we had 20 years ago.
1-800-486-8655 if you'd like to speak to Jean-Michel Cousteau. And let's go to Dave in Williams Bay. Hello, Dave. You are on At Issue.
Hi, John and Glenn. How are you?
We're doing well.
Great. I had a couple comments and then a question for John. I was a fishing guide on Lake Geneva for almost 30 years, and I was very disconnected with the damage I was doing in teaching people how to fish, kill, and eat the fish. Since then, I've gone vegan, and I don't eat fish anymore, and I've made the connections with global warming, pollution, general cruelty, nonviolence, and then the disappearing rainforest, and then the fish in the ocean. Some 90% of the largest creatures in the ocean just gone. And so when I hear John talking about the connections, I think that's great, and suggesting that you know, we use different kind of bag when we go shopping, reuse it. But ultimately, we all have the power to go vegan and stop eating animals, which is really destroying the planet more than anything, more than all the carbon emissions combined. Factory farming is just destroying it. And I'd like John to address this issue in his thoughts about veganism. And is he a vegan? Do you eat fish when you're out on your expeditions, or do you abstain from all animal products?
Thanks for your call, Dave.
Thank you very much. I'm not a vegan. I do eat fish, but not all fish. I'm very, very picky. I will not touch anything that I know is heading toward extinction. I am very picky when it comes to meat, less and less red meat, if any. And, I'm trying to become a little more aware. And at the same time, we have to be realistic. It took us, I don't know what age you are, but it took you a certain time to become vegan. Maybe I will become vegan. Who knows? But I don't think that's the answer to everybody on the planet overnight. So education is critical. And you're right. We need to explain to the decision makers the consequences of what we do and what we harvest and what we grow and so on. I try to be as realistic as possible. And I congratulate you. If you're happy, that's great.
For those of us who are fish eaters, what fish can we eat without further depleting the ocean's reserves? What should we avoid?
Well, you happen to have hit one thing. You can have the Seafood Watch.
Jean-Michel is holding a little pamphlet up here, which says Seafood Watch on it.
That's right. And you can go to the website, which is www.seafoodwatch.org. And every 6 months, you can get the updated version on what's the best choices, the good alternatives, and what to avoid. Which of the fish have mercury, which can be very, very dangerous, particularly for young people. And that can be on your telephone, on the internet, on your computer. Or you can have this little piece of paper that I have that you can fold and put in your wallet like a credit card, and when you go to a restaurant or you go shopping, you pull it out, and you know exactly what's okay, what's not okay.
It's called Sea Watch, and it's from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. I've been to that aquarium. It's a beautiful, beautiful facility.
It's a beautiful place, and you know they've adapted this nationally and also regionally and even in Spanish, and there are other countries doing the same thing. Portugal, France, and more nations are doing that.
Let's go to Bob in West Allis. Bob, you're on the radio with Jean-Michel Cousteau. Hello, Bob.
Hello. I appreciate very much you and your father's work. But one question I have is that the Mediterranean Sea, some few years ago, had some plant from the coast put in along the coast, and it had spread quite a bit. And I was wondering if that is continuing to happen or how widespread that is, and is there some way of going back on that and reducing the amount of spread or eliminating it to bring back the more natural seafloor?
Well, very good question, sir. It tells me that you're very much aware of what's going on. That plant is a seaweed, and that seaweed is occupying available space. It's not we now know that it's not taking over other spaces. It is an introduced species. It technically should not be there. But now we know that there's more than 1,000 species of plants and animals that have been introduced in the Mediterranean Sea, so much so that I can tell you where I used to dive as a child on the southern coast of France or the northern part of the Mediterranean Sea. I had never seen species then that I see today, such as barracudas. Barracudas are traditionally a tropical species which either came through the canal or to the Strait of Gibraltar, but that's one example. And now I see them by huge schools where I used to swim when I was a kid.
Do you think that's partially because of global warming and climate change?
I think it's a combination. Traffic, people who clean their bilges, there's more and more traffic and more cleaning, bilges cleaning. The fact that the southern part of the Mediterranean Sea is warming up, and the fresh water which used to come through the Nile River is no longer there because it's being harvested before it reaches the Med to irrigate farms. And the fish that come, the tropical fish that come from the Red Sea, they go there and they say, "Oh, it's not so cold. And there is food," because the nutrients from the deep part of the Med now can reach the surface when before they were capped by the fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
So things have changed and favored the arrival of many species, which today we cannot say it's bad. It's just shocking, but it's not necessarily bad.
And the Mediterranean, of course, is relatively isolated. You've got the Straits of Gibraltar, but it's kind of enclosed.
So it's almost a lake.
Anything like that would be amplified over time.
Absolutely. And it looks like a lake to me, and there's no tide, and so very little tide. So it's a test case, if you want. And there are a lot of scientists today, I would say somewhere around 2,500 scientists around the Mediterranean Sea who have joined forces to study the situation.
Jean-Michel, how serious is the threat to our coral reefs?
It's very serious. Due to the acidification, which comes with our emission of CO2, and it has increased to a point where now the coral has a very hard time to rebuild itself after a tsunami or a hurricane or some form of pollution. And it makes it very difficult, or it's going to make it more and more difficult for crustaceans such as lobsters, shrimps, crabs, to change their shells, which they have to change as they're growing. We have some issues, and you go to the Caribbean, there are places where 70% of the reef is dead. And on the average, worldwide, the scientific community will say that it's approaching 30%.
What happens to the fish and all the other species that depend on that coral reef when that happens?
It's not just the fish. It's us humans, because a lot of people depend on those fish for food, or they depend on those reefs for the protection against bad weather, because most of them live along the coastline. And when the coral goes into sand, that protection, natural protection, is no longer there. And if you look at where the coral reefs of the world are, the majority are in developing or third world country, about 85%. And the economy of these nations are going down the drain, because you as a visitor, you may not want to go there because you know it's dead.
Nowhere to snorkel.
So, yeah. And so there's a lot of issues which are linked to the coral reefs, and we need to do everything we can to protect it. Now, this lady, who may still be on the line,
I'm sure she is.
I want her to know that there are places on the planet who are still in very good shape. You can go to the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. You can go to Papua New Guinea, Fiji. The reef is still in very good shape. We're near the equator. There are no industries, very small populations, and that is an example of things that are doing very well.
Let's go back to the phones. Patricia in Madison. You are on the radio with Jean-Michel Cousteau. Hello, Patricia.
Hello. It's an honor. I want to echo what that guy said about going vegetarian and vegan as a real necessity, and it shouldn't take that long. But my concern about this, what I called about, is that I understand that only about 1% of nonprofit donations go to ocean organizations. And the problem that I see is that many people get their information in this country from the outdoors pages in our newspapers, which are totally focused on killing wildlife. They are not focused on saving anything. They are not focused on broadening the discussion to the wider ecosystem and the interconnection of life. They are focused on killing. And it's very hard to get information to the public.
Well, let me tell you, I love you. You're saying exactly the right thing. And I invite you to come on our website and ask questions, and we'll give you the answers. Indeed, we're being blackmailed with the information that sometimes reach us through the media, whether it's printed media or otherwise. We have very little resources as ocean people. There's a big conference that is coming in December, and that conference, which will put together some of the most important decision makers on the planet, is focusing on climate change. And as I looked at the agenda, there is almost nothing about the ocean. And the ocean occupies 71% of the planet.
How can you ignore the ocean when you're talking about climate change?
But she touched on that. She's exactly right. I mean, we are nuts. It's all connected. It's one system, and the ocean is a critical part of the climate issue. And unless we address it, we're not going to resolve anything. So we are struggling, Ocean Futures and other NGOs like ours, by not being supported by the resources that could be made available to take care of the ocean and make sure that it is part of the decision-making process.
Jean-Michel Cousteau, I'm Glenn Moberg, in for Ben Marins on Ad Issue. We're live at UW Stevens Point. We'll be back with more of your questions right after this short break. We are back on At Issue. I'm Glenn Moberg, in for Ben Marins. We're broadcasting live from our new studio at UW Stevens Point with a man who has been here for much of the week, Jean-Michel Cousteau. And I want to get in as many phone calls as we can, so I think we're going to go right back to the phones right now. Bruce in Algonquin, Illinois, has been waiting patiently. And Bruce, I used to live in Elgin for a long time, just downstream from you. So how are you doing, and what's your question for Jean-Michel?
Hi, it's an honor to talk with you. My question was your concern about boats on the oceans. A certain, I think it's 5 or 10 miles from shore, are allowed to dump their waste into the oceans. You know, if this is true, what is your thoughts on that? I realize probably in comparison to what gets dumped in the rivers, it's small, but it still seems wrong to me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, it is small, but it is very important, and you're absolutely right. The law, the regulations are 10 miles. A lot of those vessels cheat. They do it at night within the 12 miles or the 10 miles. And let's not forget that on one hand, you have the ones that are being attacked all the time, which are usually the cruise line. Well, cruise line are very visible, and that's why they are on the spot. But they have the most sophisticated treatment systems. Now, people cheat, but they are equipped to do the right thing. On the other hand, the ones who are getting away with it is 50,000 ships at sea 24/7. And those get away with murder. The cruise line is only 320 vessels. So we need to look at the whole picture. And I'm in contact with the cruise line, and I've told them, I said, you know, you not only should educate your passengers, you should educate your crew, and you should educate those 50,000 ships out there. And that will make you look good, because right now everybody's picking on you. So they're looking into that, and you're absolutely right. We need to have better regulations, and not only better regulations, but better technology in order to make sure that what we put in the ocean is not affecting it, and it can be done.
Environmental tourism has become a pretty big thing in recent years. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's a good thing, provided it's done properly. And when you look at, in my case, when you look at where tourism, where tourists are going, 50% of people who take a vacation go to the ocean or near the water. Tourism is the second largest industry after the defense budget. And so you're talking about here a very powerful budget. And if you can provide people with the right information, not only are they going to help protect the environment, which they have come to enjoy, but they're going to make much better decisions. And we're trying to do that. We've had a few tests in the past.
We have heard that there's a danger sometimes when you have environmental tourism, that the tourists show up and they start to ruin the environment in the process.
That's true, because they don't know. You know, the places where culture is a very big deal. And if you don't know the culture of the people where you're going, you're going to not only not have a good reputation or a good experience, but the local people are not going to like you. If you take the time to be informed and do the right thing and behave the right way, you're going to enjoy your time, your vacation immensely.
I think we've got time for one more phone call. Let's go to Rick in Madison. Rick, you're on the radio with Jean-Michel Cousteau. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Dr. Cousteau. I'm interested in your comments on the effect of endocrine-disrupting chemicals being dumped into the ocean, and specifically its effect on reproduction in fish, marine mammals, and reptiles.
Well, it's a very good question, but I will add to that, what about people? Because many of us will feed on the fish that these animals are feeding upon, where you have a high concentration of toxins, and it comes back in our plates. So we already know through the research that is done by some scientists, whom I know, and we could give you their names if you'd like to, that the work they do on domestic animals is showing that, amongst other things, their attention span is going down, the thyroid is being affected, they have cancer issues, like we found on some species of fish many years ago, and the sperm count is going down, in some cases, in cats, 50%. Well, what about us if we're feeding on the same thing? So you're right. I mean, we need to pay attention and work with those industries who are manufacturing certain products for a good reason and to help us, but there are side effects which are not identified before it's too late. You know, we had that problem with the DDT, we had that problem with the PCBs, and now we have that problem with fire retardants, which are the PBDEs. So we need to work together and help solve those problems, and we can do it.
Jean-Michel, a National Geographic article says your favorite place on Earth isn't under the seas, but it's a remote corner of Peru. Why is that?
Well, it really depends on how you look at it, but I have enjoyed Peru in more than one way because of Lake Titicaca, because of the source of the Amazon up in the Andes, because there was, he has passed away in 97, a chief, an Indian chief, who has taught me a lot. And here's a person who belongs to a tribe, which are called the Achua Indians in Peru at the border with Ecuador. And this chief one day took me around and he showed me the trees that he had planted. And he was telling me, I'll never see them big enough. My children won't. My grandchildren maybe. But my great-grandchildren will see these trees grow and they will be able to use them. And then he pointed one which was maybe 10 feet. And he said, that's going to make a good canoe. To me, that was the unwritten constitution I have his picture in my office, and I look at him every day.
We are all connected. Jean-Michel Cousteau, thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Ben Marins. We've been live at UW Stevens Point. If you want a copy of this show, we can send you a CD. Ask for show number 1029M. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Until tomorrow, take care. We'll see you on the radio.